We'll call the meeting of the Commerce Committee to order. And we do not have a quorum yet, but we're going to go ahead. We're going to be somewhat impacted by time today, so we're going to go ahead and start with the first bill on the agenda, which is House File 460, Representative Pepin. And I will go ahead and move House File 460 so it's in front of us. And Representative Pepin, welcome to the committee, and whenever you're ready, please start.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair. House File 460 is a pretty short bill, as you can see. It simply says the state building code, the state fire code, and other political subdivisions must not require the installation of fire sprinklers or their components in any new or existing single-family home. The reason I'm bringing this forward is a couple reasons. The cost of a mandatory requirement to the homeowner can range into thousands of dollars. Additionally, I'm sure a lot of people have safety on their mind. And one of the reasons I took this bill, I had some concerns about whether this was, you know, a safety issue that we needed to be concerned with and how much additional safety the sprinklers could provide. And one of the statistics I found was that according to the National Fire Protection Association, a homeowner has a 99.45% chance of survival if their home has a working smoke detector. Adding a fire sprinkler requirement increases the survival rate to 99.85%. So from a safety impact, I felt that the cost of making this sprinkler mandatory in new dwellings didn't line up very well with the additional safety benefits. So with that, I will turn it over to the witnesses.
Thank you very much. If you could identify yourself for the record, please proceed whenever you're ready.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Todd Bierstead. I'm president of the Builders Association of Minnesota. The Builders Association of Minnesota is a trade association representing over 3,000 members involved in the residential construction industry here in Minnesota. Thank you very much for allowing me to testify before the House Commerce Committee this afternoon. I'm here to testify in support of House File 460, a bill prohibiting the mandate of fire sprinklers in new single-family residential detached homes. The Builders Association of Minnesota stands with a coalition of associations opposed to mandating fire sprinklers in all new residential construction, including the Minnesota Housing Partnership, the Association of General Contractors, the Congress of Minnesota Resorts, Hospitality Minnesota, the Minnesota Realtors Association, and the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. The Builders Association of Minnesota has always supported fire prevention efforts in the course of construction, but we do not believe that mandating fire sprinklers is an added benefit to new homeowners. Minnesota has actively engaged in preventing fire deaths since 1973, when it adopted a requirement for all homes to install smoke detectors. 5 years later, Minnesota adopted language requiring hardwired smoke detectors, and in 2003, Minnesota adopted language requiring hardwired interconnected battery backup smoke detectors in all new residential construction. A little known but extremely important statistic published by the National Fire Protection Association is that occupants have a 99.45% chance of surviving a fire with at least one working smoke alarm in the home. And this statistic does not state whether or not the smoke alarm is hardwired, backed up, and interconnected as Minnesota requires. And Minnesota is not alone in passing legislation prohibiting the mandate of fire sprinklers in single-family homes. 28 states have already rejected the requirement of mandatory fire sprinklers. 19 states have pending action to prohibit the mandate or do not have codes requiring mandated sprinklers. Only California, Maryland, and Pennsylvania have adopted mandatory sprinkler language. And Pennsylvania is currently moving legislation to prohibit this requirement. And lastly, it is most important to note that fire sprinklers are and always have been an option for Minnesota homeowners. And now I'd like to invite Karen Lanier, our Director of Codes and Research at the Builders Association of Minnesota, to present the statistics on home fires in the state of Minnesota. And thank you again.
Thank you. Members, any questions? Thank you, Ms. Lanier, and state your name for the record, and please proceed. And if we can, Representative Pepin, if you have other people too, if we can avoid any duplication, and brevity is always appreciated here, so thank you.
Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of House File 460. I want to reiterate that any Minnesotan will be able to install a fire sprinkler system in their new home if they choose, and we want to keep it that way. When I was a kid, my dad was a part-time firefighter, and we knew he had a call when the phone would ring continuously until someone picked it up and hung it up, and then he knew he had to go down the station. A lot has changed since then. Thanks to changes in fire safety education, building codes that require smoke alarms and other fire safety measures, the 911 system, dispatch improvements, and improvements in firefighting techniques and equipment, the death rate has dropped considerably, the fire death rate. According to the Centers for Disease Control, from 1979 to 2003, the fire death rate per million persons from house fires dropped by more than 58%, regardless of the age of the housing, and this was as a national population grew. The decreasing number of fire deaths is a public safety success story. The entire housing stock is getting safer, and the newest homes are the safest in Minnesota. I would like to explain some fire data research that BAM conducted, which shows that the 199 fire deaths in single-family homes that have happened from 1998 to 2010. Let's not forget that each of these numbers represents a person and a family, and as someone who has lived through the agony of losing someone very close to you in a tragic accident when you couldn't say goodbye, my heart goes out to those families. I believe it's incredibly important that to prevent as many residential fire deaths in the future, we need to take a hard look at where those fire deaths occurred in the past. We also have to ask how old were the houses that burned in order to make the best public policy to save lives. The State Fire Marshal's Office does not collect the age of construction of a house when a residential fire fatality occurs, but we did. So the State Fire Marshal's Office provided BAM with the detailed records of civilian fire deaths from 1998 to 2010, which included the addresses. I used the county assessor's websites, assessor's staff, and city staff to find out those years of construction. Data were not available for 36 fires, largely due to incomplete addresses. I've also admitted fire fatalities that did not occur in single-family homes, except those that were caused by explosions, since fire sprinklers would not have saved those lives. They also don't include single-family arsons, homicides, or suicides, or mobile home fires. What I'd like to direct you to is the first graph that we handed out. At the top, it says 1998 to 2010. This graph shows 20 years of fire fatalities by decade of construction. What I'd like you to do is cover up the 1980s, the 1990s, and the 2000s with your hand. And the important thing about that is if you look at this chart and take away the last three decades of houses that were constructed, the numbers for the last 20 years would be double because the death rate dropped so much. So that's the first success story for the fire fatality rate. The second success story happens in those last three decades, and you'll see the number of deaths in those decades in this 20-year period were relatively small compared to everything else, especially in the 1990s and the 2000s where there were just six fire deaths. I'd also like to give you a quick example of why newer construction is safer. I was talking to my friend Heidi. She rents with three other 20-somethings in a 1932 house in South Minneapolis. And I said, you know, I've been reading information about smoke alarms and heard that people take out batteries from smoke alarms to use in their TV remotes. She said, yeah, my roommates tried to do that last week. And I argued them out of it. Now, what if we took those four people and we moved them into a house in Minneapolis that was built since March of 2003? That house would have hardwired, interconnected smoke alarms with battery backup on every floor and in every bedroom. So even if a roommate's used the batteries for the remote, it's hardwired. There's other code-required safety features that give people more chances to escape in those homes as well. There's an escape route, an egress window in every bedroom in the basement. There's fire blocking to help contain the fire and give them more time to get out. What you won't see in this 2010 house that exists in their 1932 house is overloaded electrical outlets, extension cords, space heaters, and wood-burning fireplaces. There's modern wiring, modern fire blocking, modern heating systems, but most importantly, modern smoke alarms. These roommates also smoke, but they only do so outside their house. And that means if they move to a 2010 house in Minnesota, they live in the safest single-family housing available. If you look at the next graph, which says civilian fire fatalities in single-family homes, What I've done is broken out the last two decades of fire deaths and when they were constructed. In this time period, this 20-year time period, we built over 430,000 single-family homes in the last 20 years. And those single-family homes house over a million Minnesotans. There have been six civilian fire deaths during that period from six different fires. Three of those deaths were from careless smoking. The other three, it couldn't be determined where they were from. Since the new building code was adopted in April of 2003, new homes require hardwired interconnected smoke alarms. What does that mean? If smoke is detected by any of the alarms, they will all sound. They will automatically sound in all bedrooms if smoke is detected anywhere in the home. But what about that one death in 2003 that happened after this code changed? It was caused by careless smoking. The Fire in Minnesota report cites that careless smoking accounts for only 4% of the structure fires, but causes 42% of the residential fire deaths. So you would ask, wouldn't a fire sprinkler have saved this person's life? Not likely if the fire was caused by a smoldering cigarette, and this is why. According to the Safe Cigarette Coalition's website, the National Association of State Fire Marshals states, if a cigarette falls near the head of a sleeping smoker, the smoldering fire can produce enough carbon monoxide to kill him or her before there's enough heat from the burning chair or bed to activate the sprinkler. What will likely save lives in newly built homes is the Fire Safe Cigarette Law passed by the legislature last year. Those cigarettes are designed to go out if they are not puffed on continually. The trend of more and more smokers not smoking in their homes will likely save lives in newly built homes as well. Adding fire sprinklers will not. Let's go back to the first graph. The data show that mandating smoke alarms in new homes is highly unlikely to decrease Minnesota's residential fire death rate. Homes without fire sprinklers are not the problem. Homes without working smoke alarms are the problem.
Thank you. Members, any questions?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Tilbury.
I was just wondering how the department felt about this particular bill. If they wanted to weigh in on it at some point.
Representative Tilbury, which department?
Department of Labor and Industry.
Okay.
Since they kind of deal with codes.
Representative Pepin, have you had any discussions with Dolly?
I haven't. They have not contacted me about the bill. I don't know if they're here to testify or not. I haven't heard.
I have not heard either. We can ask them if they have any issues with it. Other questions, members? With that, Representative Pepperin, do you have other testifiers that you? Okay. Okay. And Representative Tilbury, members, Ms. Newman has informed us that the fire code is done by the fire marshal's office. So, and I think we are going to hear from them, but. Thank you. And now if we have the anybody that wants to come down, we have a whole Mark Bruner, are you here? Mark, if you want to come down and testify when you're ready, identify yourself for the record, and please proceed. Whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Mark Bruner. I'm president of the Minnesota Manufactured Modular Housing Association, and I'm here to speak in favor of the bill. The Manufactured Modular Housing Association represents about 350 members in the state of Minnesota. Our members include the builders of manufactured and modular homes. In 2007, we built about 4,000 new manufactured homes and about 2,000 new modular homes. There are approximately 1,000 licensed manufactured home parks or communities in the state that are home to about 50,000 Minnesota families. All of the above would be impacted if Minnesota were to require fire sprinklers in homes. Manufactured and modular homes would also be required to install sprinklers. One of the issues that we have with our homes is that about 50% of what we build today in our eight plants in the state are exported to other states and to Canada. Those states that we're exporting to right now don't require fire sprinklers. If we were to have to start putting homes with that required sprinklers in the production line. It would greatly increase our costs of efficiencies in terms of being able to build homes to one uniform code, which the HUD building code allows us to do nationally. Additionally, our national association has estimated that to add sprinklers to a smaller manufactured home, say about 1,200 square feet, would add an additional $4,000 to the cost of that home. To add sprinklers to a 3,000 square foot manufactured home would add an additional $7,000. And essentially, manufactured homes in Minnesota are the state's largest source of non-subsidized affordable housing. And the folks that buy our homes are buying our homes because they're affordable. And in today's mortgage market, if you're going to add another $4,000 or $7,000 to the cost of a home, that's going to be on top of the down payment that's required. You know, those kinds of increased costs are no longer financeable. You just can't roll it into the cost of the home like you could 5-6 years ago. So essentially, adding a sprinkler requirement in Minnesota would really preclude those that are buying our homes from continuing to buy our homes. So I would encourage you to move forward with the bill for those reasons. And additionally, if someone wanted to put sprinklers in a manufactured or modular home, they could do that today. In 2007, the Department of Labor and Industry issued a bulletin that outlines what the requirements are if you're going to install a sprinkler system in a single-family dwelling, which included manufactured and modular homes. So if someone came to one of our sales centers and said they wanted to add a sprinkler option, we could do that today by following the state building code. They obviously would have to pay for it, but that is something that is permissible currently today. We just don't want to see it mandatory. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Bruner. Representative Muller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Bruner, I guess I didn't understand. You said there's one HUD code for all building. Now, are you not subject to all of the building codes of the different states? Because I know that the international code, which is now being... Some states are still under the Uniform Building Code. Some are under the International. I know it's not adopted the same way in each state. Minnesota, each time they look at it, they adopt it a different way from the regular. So each state has their own, but you were talking about one national code. Are you not subject then to the state building codes at all, or what?
Mr. Bruner.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Mullery. We're susceptible to the state building code in situations where the federal building code might be silent. One of those areas is fire sprinklers and fire suppression in terms of if that were to become a part of the state building code. With regard to other parts of the HUD code, for example, roof load requirements, energy code requirements, those kinds of things, those are addressed in the federal building code. So if Minnesota were to make a change to its IRC code, that wouldn't affect the manufactured homes or the federal building code. Only aspects of the code that aren't addressed would be affected by the state building code.
Representative Muller.
So, like, I remember the plumbing code, the piping, the pipe code for piping. Those are all, we adopted some things different in those, and some construction people here could probably go through all the different things. You're not covered by all of those?
Mr. Bruner.
There is the federal building code does have within it a plumbing code as well as electrical code, which is essentially the NEC code for manufactured homes. Once you get outside the home in terms of the plumbing and the piping, you would then comply with the state plumbing code. But the plumbing within the home would have to comply with the federal building code.
Thank you, Mr. Bruner. Other questions, members? If not, we'll go to Mr. Halbach. Please identify yourself for record and proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Chip Halbach, the Executive Director of Minnesota Housing Partnership. The Housing Partnership is a nonprofit organization concerned about the affordable housing conditions in Minnesota. We represent the for-profit affordable housing industry, public agencies, and nonprofit. And we are also work, our members work in the area of single-family home development, such as Habitat for Humanity, to multifamily development. Our board discussed this legislation at its meeting in February, and we unanimously supported this bill to restrict communities from requiring fire sprinklers. The reason we did so was because of affordability. Minnesota faces the seventh straight year where the proportion of residents in the state paying over half their income for housing has increased. Minnesota faces a situation where both in the lower home ownership realm as well as with rental housing, more people are in need than before. We have called upon the legislature to increase affordable housing resources to help maintain our supply of affordable housing, both lower income ownership to rental, but we don't see the resources being there anywhere close to what the need is. So then we turn to how can we control costs? And this bill is one of those that helps preserve the cost of lower cost housing that's being built or the return of foreclosed properties to the market. So just from a reason that there's many people, even with prices of housing declining, there's many people out there who can't afford it, and we have a big uphill climb in meeting that need across the state. We feel that it's not the time to look at or to impose a sprinkler requirement on single-family homes. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Halbach. Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Halbach, you're talking about the cost. What is the actual cost, and is that also... I obviously am not an expert on this, to say the least. My understanding, there's some new ways of doing it that basically use the same plumbing system, so that the old way of having a kind of a separate system that was very costly is no longer the case necessarily. What are the actual costs if you use the new way of doing it?
Mr. Halbach.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mullery. We aren't the experts on cost on that. More of our members have put in sprinklers on multifamily housing, but we'd seen estimates that range from $5,000 to $20,000 per unit. So I would look to other witnesses to directly answer your question.
Ms. Leonard, did you want to respond to this question?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mulroy, yes, I would. We don't have a lot of our builders don't have a lot of experience because there's so few of these installed. However, I can give you a cost estimate from the National Association of Home Builders. Before I move into that, I will tell you one of our builders had to put a system in on his house because he was too far from a fire lane, and he is on city sewer. He's not on city water, and they have a well, and he did not have to replace the well. So the cost of that system was $16,000. It included two tanks in the basement. They had to upgrade their pump from a residential pump to a commercial pump, plus the cost of the fire system. So in that case, in the house he built, that was $3.75 a square foot. Of course, it depends on the size of the house, and that's going to be less for houses on public water supplies. But I've seen estimates range from National Association of Home Builders and other sources that range from $2 a square foot all the way to $6 a square foot if you do have to dig another well.
Thank you. Representative Mullery, does that answer your question?
Probably as good an answer as I'm going to get today. It definitely doesn't answer it.
Good answer. Thank you. Mr. Egger from the Realtors, would you like to come up and speak briefly? Identify yourself for the record and please proceed.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Paul Egger, Vice President of Governmental Affairs for the Minnesota Association of Realtors, representing the 18,000 realtors throughout Minnesota. And Mr. Chairman, I will be very brief. Our association does support House File 460, and in particular the inclusion of the prohibiting a mandate on existing single-family homes. From our perspective, a mandate for sprinkler systems on existing family homes would present not only the cost factor that you've heard from other witnesses, but just logistically would be quite a challenge to implement. So, Mr. Chairman, with that, I'll conclude my comments.
Thank you, Mr. Hager. Members, any questions? Representative Mullery.
Mr. Chairman, is there any proposal to do it on existing? I'd heard it was only on new.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mullery, I'm not aware of any proposal to apply to existing, but existing is in the bill, and so we thought we'd speak to that matter.
Representative Mullery.
Mr. Chairman, the existing is in the bill just the other way. It's
yes.
not that there's any proposal.
Mr. Chairman, correct. That's my understanding as well.
Thank you. Other questions, members? If not, we will proceed to the people that are here to speak against the bill. Thank you, Mr. Rager. Mr. Rosendahl. If you could identify yourself for the record, please proceed whenever you're ready, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I'm Jerry Rosendahl, the Minnesota State Fire Marshal. I'm here today in opposition to House File 460 on behalf of the Minnesota Department of Public Safety. Our opposition is based on the state's nearly four decades of experience in adopting state building and fire codes through the rulemaking process. This bill presents us from dealing with an available critical life safety strategy in our codes, one known to save lives, property, and the environment. The Departments of Public Safety and Labor and Industry jointly prepare our state's building and fire code updates for adoption through the rulemaking process, with the goal of ensuring that our citizens and visitors enjoy a reasonable degree of protection from fire. The rulemaking process put in place by the legislature is a very lengthy process which needs and is designed to allow diverse opinions into the discussions. The goal is a consensus document. When that is not possible, hearings are held and an administrative law judge determines the outcome. The residential sprinkler requirement under scrutiny here is actually found in a national model code known as the International Residential Code, not the fire code as mentioned previously. Minnesota uses these model codes as a base for designing our state codes. Then during a thorough review process, we make amendments to the model code to fit Minnesota. We can't even start our review process for the new codes until April of 2011, when the 2012 edition is in print of the IRC. At that point, advisory committees will be formed, meetings will be held with all interested parties. This review process for a new edition of the state codes typically takes about 18 months. The likely effective date of the new codes, if it includes this provision or some variation thereof, is the spring of 2013. The Department of Public Safety encourages the opponents of residential sprinklers to engage in this lengthy review process. That is where discussion should take place on water supplies, alarms, fire department connections, maintenance, sprinklering fish houses, and seasonal properties, all issues which either aren't required in the model code or probably won't be required in the final version of the Minnesota code, because discussions have taken place in the rulemaking process and reasonable people have come to an agreement. There are entirely too many TV shows and movies that have you believing you can pull a fire alarm and the sprinkler system goes off. Or when one sprinkler head goes off, they all go off. It makes for good TV, but it distorts the true operation of this life-saving technology. With regard to the need for sprinklers, I have two major life safety and firefighter safety concerns about the homes being built today. One is what is referred to as lightweight construction. Full-scale fire tests done by independent firms have shown floor collapse in 10 minutes in this new type of construction. In many communities, this is about the time when firefighters are searching for victims or fighting the fire inside. The second is the combustibility of the materials we put into the home environment these days, mostly plastic. The tenability or survivability time in a home fire has dropped from 17-plus minutes in 1975 to 3 minutes now. This is based on a study conducted by the U.S. Department of Commerce, National Institute of Standards and Technology. This bill prevents us from dealing with an available critical life safety strategy in our codes, one known to save lives, property, and the environment. Mr. Chairman, I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Rosendahl. Members, any questions? Seeing none. Thank you, sir. Next up, Mr. Sanders, from the National Fire Protection Association.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak today. My name is Russ Sanders. I am the Central Regional Director for the National Fire Protection Association. The NFPA is a not-for-profit organization. We have some 70,000 members. We've been in business for over 100 years, since 1896, and our sole mission is fire and life safety. Let me quickly talk about the fire problem in this country. There was a fire in this country every 82 seconds. There's more than 3,000 civilian deaths in this country every year, 17,000 civilian injuries. 62% of the firefighter deaths occur in residential properties. Of that 62%, 92% occur in one- and two-family dwellings. That's where firefighters are dying in this state and dying throughout the country. 84% of fire deaths occur in the home. Nearly $16 billion in direct property loss is what we deal with every year in this country. Who's at highest risk? Children under 5 and adults over 65. And these are the groups that in most cases are not helped by smoke detectors. Just on in route here today, I was listening to a report on the radio of a study that was just released this morning from Australia. They found that in children 5 to 15 years old, more than two-thirds are not awakened by smoke detectors. More than two-thirds are not awakened by the technology we have today in smoke detectors. NFPA's goal is very simple. We want to make sure that decision makers have the facts and up-to-date, accurate information, and that's what I'm here to share with you today. And let me start by mentioning that NFPA's been mentioned twice since I've been here today. Both times it was information taken out of context. So I'm going to jump over and address that 99.4% statistic right off the bat. The way that came about, that's a very comprehensive NFPA report. There are 400,000 fires in this country every year. There are 3,000 fire deaths. If you do the math, that's 99.4%. What you're not being told is the vast majority of those fires are not life safety threats at all. This is burnt toast. This is flue fires in a chimney, fires contained in a cooking vessel, things that would not even set off the smoke detector, much less be any threat to life and safety. In this country, 23% of reported home fires go beyond the room of origin, 23%. And that 23% of fires kill 77% of the people in their homes. Of that 77%, sprinklers would have saved 98% of those people. 98% of the time, the sprinkler system would have put the fire out. So when you're looking at fires that really are causing deaths in this country, it's sprinklers that are saving lives. As I said, our job is to give you accurate, up-to-date information. One question was cost. And I should mention, NFPA commissioned third parties to do these studies, so this is not NFPA's work. The first one is an NFPA affiliate, which is Fire Protection Research Foundation. We found that they looked at 20 communities. This is not hypothetical. They went out and looked at 20 communities that currently have ordinances in place. They found an average cost of $1.61 per square foot. It costs more to upgrade your carpet in a new home than $1.61 per square foot. Newport Partners, we contracted with them because we hear a lot about economic development. We've heard that today again, how it will have an adverse effect on economic development. So we looked at four counties, all in the metropolitan Washington, D.C. area that have very similar demographics. We paired Montgomery County, it was the University of Maryland working with NFPA. We paired Montgomery County with Maryland with Fairfax County, Virginia. Montgomery County has an ordinance and has been in place for many years, a sprinkler ordinance. Prince George's County, we compared them with Anne Arundel County. Prince George's County has had a sprinkler ordinance for many years. We found absolutely no adverse impact in economic development whatsoever. There were just as many home starts in the counties with sprinklers as there were in the counties without sprinklers. No evidence whatsoever. Another issue you'll hear quite often about is water fee, the cost of water, that it adds an unreasonable cost to the sprinkler system. Again, we hired Newport Partners. They looked at 20 randomly selected communities throughout the United States. They found that there were no insurmountable cost in water meters, water fees, tap fees, etc. whatsoever. In fact, in more than half the communities they looked at, there was no additional cost at all. In the other half, the average was $400. That's a one-time fee. We looked at green. Being green is a big issue today, so we worked with FM Global to look at the green issue. What we found was that obviously there was a reduced amount of pollution released into the environment in the sprinklered home, and there was less runoff, toxic water runoff. Now, these were two full-scale burns. We found that the reduced fire damage in the sprinkler building was 97%, and the reduced water usage was 90%. I mentioned Prince George's County earlier. Prince George's County was the first county in the United States to have an ordinance in place. It's been in place now for more than 15 years. So we went back to Prince George's County, working with, again, with the Maryland State Fire Marshal's Office, University of Maryland, and we found that over that 15-year period, there were 13,494 house fires in Prince George's County. There were 101 deaths. No deaths in the sprinkler buildings, in the sprinkler homes. And there were 245 fires in sprinkler homes, no deaths in those homes. We also went out with hired Newport Partners to look at incentives, because a lot of communities, a lot of states, where they do have an adoption, they do provide incentives. And by the way, there are hundreds of local ordinances throughout the United States, and there are four states that have passed legislation, not three. We looked at homeowner incentives, and on the average, that was 100. This is per building lot. That was $145 recurring. That's tax incentives, basically. Builder incentives, and this is basically reduced fire ratings for building assemblies. That was a savings on average of $1,949. And developer incentives was on average $1,271, and that figure does not take into place reduced cul-de-sacs or increased dead-end street length. If we factor that in as well, it would have been an additional $10,752. Final study I want to mention, and by the way, I have written testimony that outlines, gives you much more detail on each of these studies, and we have comprehensive reports available to anybody that if you want to see any of these reports in detail. But the February 11 report that we finished was with Exponent, and again, we looked at water usage and water performance. On average, water usage for homes in homes with fire sprinklers was only 12% what the water was in a home without sprinklers. This was based on a 10-minute average, and the standard that requires to install sprinklers requires a 10-minute flow. We also found something very interesting, and that is water infrastructure demand is reduced by 47% or more when sprinklers in a community are protected with home fire sprinkler systems. I know we only have a few minutes today, and I think exactly as the state fire marshal pointed out, that's the problem. These are complex issues that usually take 18 months or longer to decide when everybody has a chance to really put the information before the regulatory process. That's a real problem with dealing with these type of code issues in legislative hearings. But I just want to ask you today, please do not pass this bill. I've been in the fire service 40 years. I was a chief of a major fire department for 9 years. I spent 29 years in that department. In many cases, I look to Minnesota because Minnesota has a reputation of leading the country in fire safety and life safety issues. Please don't hamstring your fire service in this state with this bill, and that's exactly what you'll do. Thank you very much for your time. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Sanders. Representative Anzels.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned the word cul-de-sac.
Yes, sir.
Well, you know, in greater Minnesota, in townships and unorganized territory out in the country, we don't deal with cul-de-sacs very much. And I was just wondering if you know of one township government anywhere in the country, or one unorganized area in rural America that has this mandate requirement for sprinkler systems in residences.
Absolutely. Mr. Sanders.
The entire state of California, for one. Every community in California is required.
I'm not talking about communities. Rural areas.
If you build a house in the state of California, it must be sprinklered. Period.
Any other questions, members? Mr. Shearer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Marty Shearer. I'm the Fire Chief of the Medina Fire Department, also the President of the State Fire Chiefs Association. Also have with me Luke Stemmer, who's the Chief of St. Louis Park Fire Department and also the Chair of our Code Committee. You'll hear lots of different facts and figures. I can just tell you what I know. I've been Chief for 12 years. We've had four fire deaths in my city. Every one of them had working smoke detectors. The last one we just had was December 14th of 2010. We had a fire in a single-family residence. Two people lived there, both elderly. One person was awakened by the smoke detector and was able to escape. The other person was awakened by the smoke detector, not able to escape. She was found right near the exit of the building. Clearly, fire sprinklers would have saved her life. Fire sprinklers not only save people's lives, they prevent injuries. They also save firefighters' lives. Firefighters have to go in these buildings. As Mr. Rosendahl mentioned, after 10 minutes you can have a structural collapse in new buildings, and the firefighters are arriving and attacking the fire and going in the building when structural collapse could occur. We're really concerned about the safety of our firefighters, not only deaths in, but also lots of injuries of our firefighters, which is a very, not only a tragic event, but also a costly event. Lightweight construction is a very serious issue to the fire service, and you have to take that into consideration when you're dealing with this. What we're really asking for is not for you to decide whether we should have sprinklers requirement in buildings now, but we're asking for you to let the process go through the normal process through, as Marshall Rosendahl mentioned, the Department of Labor and Industries process. It takes about, you know, almost 2 years for this process to go through. We're going to have maybe 30, 60 minutes of testimony here. We have plenty of time in the normal process to let that go through. There's an appeals process. It's the right way to do things. So lots of people get notified. I don't know if everyone that's concerned about this bill has been notified that this hearing is going on. I don't think so. So I think it's really important that we follow the process that's worked very well for many years. I don't know if sprinklers will be successful in being required, or I'm sure they may have a chance to do it, but it won't include, as mentioned, probably existing homes. We're not looking to sprinkler existing homes. We're not looking to have seasonal temporary homes be sprinklered. We're looking for a lot of work and a lot of compromise, actually, in this bill. So I think, just to be brief, in the long run, this actually saves money. It saves everyone money, health care costs, injuries are reduced, insurance costs are reduced. I know in a commercial residence, you can gain back the cost of a sprinkler system about 7 years. In a home, it's going to be a little bit longer than that, maybe about 10 years. So we really want this to go through the normal process and not pass on this bill.
Thank you, Chief Shearer. Chief Stemmer.
Good morning. Thank you, or afternoon. Thank you for the chair and the committee. Like other people here,
Chief,
been
if you could, we're on tape. If you could identify yourself for the record, we make it official.
That's
thank you.
Not a problem. I'm Luke Stemmer. I'm the fire chief for the city of St. Louis Park, and I'm here representing the State Fire Chiefs Association as chairman of their code committee. And as chairman of the code committee, it's my job to work with a very diverse group of individuals made up of fire chiefs, fire marshals, industry professionals, state fire marshal's office, as well as the Department of Labor and educational people, to sit down, analyze codes, particularly how they affect the fire service and how that moves forward, and try to work with compromises and cost effectiveness to incorporate them into the fire code. We recommend to the fire marshal office, who works with the Department of Labor and Industry, to put it in effect. I've heard that the code process is not unlike making laws, where it's kind of like making sausage, and you get all done. It's not necessarily pretty, but when you get done, you have a good solid basis to work with. And the code process is very similar to that. It's a give and take. All the parties are involved in it, as you've heard reference to. It's nothing that starts quickly. It takes time to go through it. We have public information meetings, and everybody has opportunities to have give or take. It's that process that I think is being circumvented here that we need to allow it to work. It hasn't had an opportunity to start yet. I would point out a couple of things. One is that we've talked about most of the fire deaths being in single-family homes that aren't sprinkled. And in fact, we don't have many fire deaths in office buildings like this, because everybody's awake and easy to get along, but you'll notice that we are protected down here this afternoon with sprinkler systems. And we do have a way to install that in homes. There was a time and place when airbags were something of a fancy in automobiles. And now you won't hardly find one without one. You have to start somewhere. I've started in the fire service in 1971. I remember when smoke detectors were a new item. Nobody wanted to put them in the homes. They were too expensive. They were an extra thing that we had to put in. Now they're required in every home. We had to draw a line in the sand somewhere and say, let's start here. The homes that, you're right, the homes that people are being killed in are older homes. But there's more older homes than newer homes out there. And that's just a fact of life. You've heard firefighters dying in new construction. Once it gets in the lightweight construction, we have less than 10 minutes before we start seeing collapse. If you walk through Target or Walmart or any of those stores and you look at the furniture that they sell, ask yourself how much of the furniture that we see today is made out of plastics or some type of plastic coating. Smoke detectors back in the 70s and 80s smoke detector go off, a family would have maybe 10 minutes to get out of a house. Smoke detector goes off today, as Chief Shearer just said, one gets out, one doesn't, because we have 2 to 3 minutes for the family to escape because of the tenseness of the fire and the plastics and flashover. Sprinkler systems stop that flashover. Might not put the fire out, but it'll allow the family additional time to escape. Thank you very much for your time, and please let the process work itself out.
Thank you, Chief. Members, any questions? Representative Kiefer.
Thank you, Chair. You mentioned before about insurance costs going down because of this. I know two people personally that have had malfunctions with their ice cube makers in their refrigerators, and the damage from the water that leaked out of that fridge just in an hour was very expensive to fix and, of course, was covered by insurance. So I'm just wondering, what are the chances of something with a sprinkler system? Now you've got the system all over the house. Is there any potential that this could end up costing more and actually raising insurance rates because of malfunctions?
Either Chief want to take this?
I'll gladly take that. I can answer your question. History has shown that you'll get about a 10% reduction in your homeowner's insurance if you sprinkle your house. So that tells me the insurance industry feels that they're going to save money by having a sprinkler system in their house. I can't promise you that you'll never have a ruptured pipe maybe from a sprinkler system, but that we're finding that to be pretty rare. As Marshall Rosedale mentioned, when there is a fire, normally most fires are controlled by one sprinkler head, and the amount of water that comes out doesn't take a lot of water to put a fire out. And by the time the fire department gets there, shuts the system down, it's actually quite little bit of water damage, but very little fire damage compared to what it was. We respond to calls all the time that the sprinkler head puts out the fire, and there's very little damage, very little water damage, and I think the insurance company saves a lot of money.
Thank you, Chief. Is there anyone else in the audience that wants to testify for or against this bill? Please come down and make your way here. And I've mentioned this earlier, but we are at a stage where we need to be brief in our testimony. We need to vote on this bill in the very near future. So, Ms. Weaver or Ms. Perry, if you could go ahead.
Members, my name is Pam Perry. I'm the Executive Vice President of the Builders Association of Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. I want to talk about the code process briefly because we failed to mention that earlier this fall, the Department of Labor and Industry brought all the parties together at a fire sprinkler task force to start discussing whether there would be some type of a compromise on this issue. And unfortunately, we never started with, well, gee, should we have fire sprinklers at all? The department started with, we will have fire sprinklers, and what is the industry willing to compromise with? So I think the industry felt that it was, because this is not a technical issue, and normally we would agree with the state fire marshal that code issues belong in the code, because the code is a very technical document. But this issue is a public policy issue. It is not a technical issue. The question is, whether do you want to require new family construction to have fire sprinklers or not, the cost ramifications of it, and the future construction industry is at stake here. So I would ask you to consider that normally we would agree this is a code issue, but not with fire sprinklers, not with the requirement of fire sprinklers in single-family homes. It has nothing to do with the technical issues. It has everything to do with a public policy objective. So I just want to
thank you, Ms. Perry. Sir, if you'd like to come up and identify yourself for the record, and please proceed.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I'm Tom Joachim. I represent the Association of Minnesota Building Officials, AMBO. AMBO is an organization representing building officials and building inspectors who perform the inspections of single-family homes in the municipalities who have adopted the state building code here in Minnesota. I am here today to speak in opposition to House File 460 for the following reasons. Number one, the law establishing the state building code charges the Department of Labor and Industry to adopt rules to establish the detailed codes that make up the state building code. This bill would move the rule from statute for that responsibility. The legislature has established a process called the Administrative Procedure Act, where all state agencies charged in law to adopt rules must follow to provide an open and transparent process for all the interested parties to participate in. This bill would take that open process away from the many interested individuals who have detailed interest on this issue. This residential sprinkler issue has not been vetted through that process. The department, as Ms. Weaver spoke, the department held three meetings last fall. I retired December 29th. I was the assistant commissioner with the Department of Labor and Industry and chair of that committee. And I will say, in opposition to what her comment was, that the department went into there saying sprinklers are going to happen here in Minnesota. Our choice, along with Commissioner Swigum at the time, was to bring these parties together to try and see if there's any common ground between what the fire service wants and what the builders wanted, and if there was any common ground for us to negotiate. So I'll contradict her view of that committee. AMBO would like to see the rules process allowed time to work through these concerns to see if there is any common ground to address some of these issues. There's one point that needs to be brought up, I think, that the State Fire Marshal's Office provides on their website, is 47% of the fires in Minnesota residences start in the kitchen. In the sprinkler options that we discussed at these three meetings last fall was, would it be reasonable to look at a two or three head system versus the full sprinkler system in single family homes? If we could stop almost 50% of the fires with one head in a single family home. To me, that was something that was worth discussing, and this legislation that would say you can't even look at anything would prohibit the department, the fire service, and the builders from negotiating some type of compromise to options at least to look at. In closing, AMBO believes this legislation is premature. Please give the rules process an opportunity to discuss and debate the specific code issue. Thank you for the opportunity to address this committee.
Thank you. Members, any questions? Or is there anyone else in the audience that wants to testify for or against before we move to a vote? Representative Pepin, do you want the final word?
Mr. Chair, I do have a question for the. I've been waiting for an opportunity to ask the chief author a question.
I was going to ask that. Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Pepin, relative to the code process, which has been, as far as I know, been ongoing for decades, can you give me just a couple, three instances where it hasn't worked right?
Representative Pepin.
I think Representative Atkins, that answer to that probably is that I would say that this isn't new precedent. My understanding is that they've done this through statute with carbon monoxide detectors, radon. So this, doing this through statute, isn't something that's never been done before. Reps.
Mr. Chair, Representative Atkins and members, my name is Lisa Frenette. I'm with Frenette Legislative Advisors, and I represent the Builders Association of Minnesota. There has been, I can think of one instance right off the bat where we had a problem where this didn't work with the rulemaking process, and it was a window sill protection. I just said it wrong, but what we did when we went through the last code process was we wanted window sills to be installed in a particular way so that we did not have water running into houses where we came up with mold issues and warranty issues, and we wanted water to stream out. We ran up against a problem with the Department of Labor and Industry on that. We had to take it through the ALJ process. We ended up winning that battle against the Department of Labor and Industry, but that's one particular instance that I can think of right off the bat where it did not work going through the rulemaking process and having to take it up to an ALJ.
Thank you, Ms. Burnett. Representative Atkins.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I didn't know that window sills were part of the fire code, but perhaps they are. But it sounds like the process was one. Representative Pepin, was it a week ago? We passed a bill in the House that lifted a moratorium on discussing nuclear power, and now we've got a bill in front of us that would place a moratorium on having folks discuss sprinkler systems. And it strikes me that the process has barely begun, and that we at least ought to give it an opportunity to go through it. Unless Ms. Frenette or somebody else can point out a situation where the fire code process failed. And I'm just not, I kind of pay attention. I'm not aware of any instances where it's just out and out failed. And why not at least allow the discussion rather than putting a ban on the discussion? Let the discussion take place, see what it yields, and then I'll wait for you. And then if there's a disagreement, there's a process that people can follow to go to an administrative law judge. Shouldn't we at least give the process an opportunity to work?
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Atkins, I can turn that around on you. I believe you did vote against that bill, so apparently we're in the exact opposite positions on the
the bill. Coincidentally.
No, you're wrong.
Consistency is the hobgoblin of a weak mind, though, Representative Pepin.
He voted for the bill.
No, he didn't vote for the bill. He voted against the bill.
I supported the bill. You just wouldn't put any parameters on it that were reasonable. And now this one...
What you're proposing here now is
an outright ban on any discussion, if I'm reading it right. We wouldn't even let the process go.
Well, Representative Atkins, I just want to remind everyone that there's nothing in this bill that prevents anyone from putting in a sprinkler in their home. And, you know, it was just coincidentally, we were just listening, we had one chief talk about how we're not looking at existing homes. Another one said that all these people are dying in fires in older homes. We're not preventing anybody from putting in a sprinkler in their home. Anybody has the ability to do that. If you'd like to put a sprinkler in your home, I'm sure the builders would be happy to do that. I mean, my overall concern here is just the sheer cost of it. And, you know, I don't think we're setting any new precedent here. And I think this is an acceptable way to go about it.
Representative Atkins.
Just the question itself. You know the answer?
Representative Pippen.
I heard about windowsills. Is there any instance in the scores of this is, you know, the fire code process that's been going on? It's a very genuine question. It's not a setup. I didn't get a little card from any of the fire chiefs or anything like that. But can you point me at some situations where the fire code process has failed?
Ms. Berry.
Mr. Chair, Representative Atkins, we are not talking about the fire code. We're talking about the residential building code. And I think I think we can agree that we're discussing whether fire sprinklers should be in the building code, not the fire code. And yes, there are times when the legislature does overrule what's happening in the code process. You've done it with the requirement of carbon monoxide detectors. You've done it with radon, and you've done it with energy requirements. You want residential construction to be more energy efficient. So you basically overruled the code process and said, figure out a way to be more energy efficient. So you do this relatively frequently. So and you do want to make those decisions. I think the second issue you need to consider is, while the code process is it is a fair process, the Department of Labor and Industry does an excellent job putting a committee together, it is an advisory committee. It is not the final say. There's one person who will be making a decision on the code, and it is the Commissioner of the Department of Labor and Industry. Because the Commissioner of the Department of Labor and Industry can undo anything that the Code Advisory Committee has put together, for any reason or for no reason. So this is a circumstance where, okay, fire sprinklers, everyone understands it. There's cost issues. There's, you know, I'm not sure if the data, we don't believe that the data supports the requirement. So who do you want to make that decision? One person at the Department of Labor and Industry or the legislature? And it's the builder's opinion that it should be the legislature because it is such a broader issue other than just technical. Does that answer your question?
Representative Atkins.
I think very thoroughly. I appreciate that, sure. Ms. Perry. My only follow-up to that is I believe in each of the instances that you raised, radon, carbon monoxide, mm-hmm. and the other, the process was followed. And then we didn't like the outcome, and then it came to the legislature. This one, the process hasn't begun. There was a meeting or two that there's apparently a disagreement over whether or not it was a done deal or not, but it sounds like from Mr. Joachim's testimony that there was some possibilities anyway of some common ground trying to be found, and it doesn't sound like we've given an opportunity for that process to take its course.
Ms. Berry.
Mr. Chair, Representative Atkins, I think here at the legislature in Minnesota, yes, but the International Code Council is that body that develops the model code, and I would say that that's where this battle began, whereby individuals could vote on that model code who were, you could essentially, the code process, how do I say this? You know, in order to get in the code, product manufacturers work to try to get in the building code, okay? And unfortunately, the International Code Council process is not similar to your process, where it's a democratic process. We are fighting this issue at this level now because we do not believe that the way fire sprinklers got into the model code to begin with was fair. And we unfortunately believe that companies bought their way into the code, and the International Code Council process did not protect themselves from that type of voting circumstance. So, unfortunately, in this case, the process, again, in our opinion, didn't work. So we are going
Thank
to
you,
the
Ms.
legislature.
Thank you, Ms. Perry. Representative Atkins, does that answer
I
your question?
I just want to make sure that Ms. Perry wasn't disparaging, and I don't think she intended to, Minnesota's process, which
no.
has not
right.
even begun, but has said that the international folks were essentially bought off, is I think the term you used.
I think you said that.
Well, I think we could read the record back. That's a pretty serious and disparaging remark to make, and it's
yeah.
very, and one you wouldn't make lightly.
No,
so,
no.
well, none of us would abide by that. The fact is, though, that I think everybody grants that Minnesota's process has yet to even begin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Atkins, and I would say that the Department of Labor and Industry has always put together a good, fair process. But this yep. is a circumstance where we think it's a broader public policy issue. So I'd like you to keep that in mind.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Perry. Representative Pepin, any final words?
No. Thank you.
With that, members, I will renew my motion that House File 460 be passed and moved on to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed?
No.
No.
Motion prevails. Motion is passed and the House File 460 is moved on to the General Register. Thank you, Representative Pepin. Thank you, members. Thank you, everybody that testified for and against. Representative Lilly, please start whenever you're ready.
Look at me. Look at all the opponents. Whose bill is this one in the minute?
We got to do the minutes too. We'll do those. Go ahead whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Yeah.
House File 571 provides an exemption to overtime requirements.
Sorry, Representative Lee, folks, can we have you be, I know we just got done with a big bill, but if we could be quiet on our way out, we need to move on to our next bill. Thank you. Representative Lilly, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 571 provides an exemption to overtime requirements for air carrier employees when the hours worked are exceed 48 hours. So this is a voluntary agreement among employees to trade shifts and to and so we're trying to create a situation where that's acceptable to have that they can voluntarily do this. Delta Airlines is the number one airline in the country, and over the last couple of years we've had some transitions, as everybody knows, with the airline changing from Northwest to Delta, but during that time we've been led by the gentleman next to me, Mr. Bill Lynch, and one of the things that he's done is he's tried to have a lot of town meetings and those sort of things, and out of those they've had input from employees and concerns and discussions, and one of the things that's come forward is this exact situation. So essentially this will do then is allow employees then to work additional shifts, and then it wouldn't cost the company money. But what I'd like to do is introduce Mr. Lynch, and he's the head of our entire Minnesota operations, and he can kind of describe how it came about and that sort of thing.
You know, Representative Lilly, it was loud earlier and I didn't hear. Did you actually move the bill?
I did not move the bill.
Why don't you move that so it's officially in front of us? I wasn't sure if you did or not. And then we'll proceed with Mr. Lynch and a whole line of others that are lined up to come down too. Representative Lilly, you're going to move?
I'd like to move House File 571.
Right to the General Register, as far as I know.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Mr. Lynch, please identify yourself for the record and proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, my name is Bill Lynch. I'm the Senior Vice President of Minnesota Operations for Delta Airlines, and I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to testify in front of your committee on behalf of thousands of Delta employees in the state of Minnesota. The purpose of this bill is to enable Delta employees in Minnesota to have the flexibility to voluntarily, and I do want to stress the word voluntarily, trade schedule work hours with fellow employees, which may result in an unbalanced set of work weeks. And I'll give you a quick example. At Delta Airlines, employees work under an 80-hour, two-week work period. Normally, under normal circumstances, that's two 40-hour work weeks. But because of the dynamic nature of our operation, and an operation that runs every minute of every year. It's very important for our employees to have flexibility to be able to trade voluntarily with fellow employees so that in one work week they may work more than 48 hours, and in another work week, much less than 40 hours. This flexibility is currently offered to Delta employees in the large majority of states where we operate, including Georgia, Michigan, New York, places where we run large hub operations and or reservation centers. This flexibility is allowed, provided it does not result, in payment of overtime. And I want to stress that this is something that has been requested by many of the employees here in the state of Minnesota, some of who are sitting here and have joined us in this chamber, representing locations in Chisholm, Minneapolis, and the like. Until recently, Delta has been able to allow this flexibility in Minnesota. That's because employees were contract employees, and swapping of hours without payment of overtime was permitted under their contract. Employees recently voted to be non-contract employees and therefore fall under the Minnesota state law regarding overtime as it relates to, among other things, voluntary swapping. So what we are seeking here is to exempt airline employees from the overtime provisions of the Minnesota Fair Labor Standards Act, an exemption that's afforded to 19 other types of employees, some in the transportation industry, including taxi cab drivers, truck drivers, ship workers. This exemption would permit Delta employees in Minnesota to have the same work schedule flexibility as their colleagues do in other states. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lynch. We have a couple of questions. Representative Vanzel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I assume your use of the term non-contract employee means the literal interpretation of that is they're at-will employees with no collective bargaining agreement. Is that correct?
Representative.
Is that correct?
Yes.
I'm intrigued with how it is that the workers, all of them, had an equal opportunity and just were needing this flexibility. How was it that you conducted the research, or did you do interviews, or did you do individual worker surveys? How do you get a sense of what a group of disorganized workers, as opposed to a group of organized workers, really want?
Mr. Lynch.
Sure. Representative, over the last 2 years I've been in this role running the Minnesota operations, I've had the opportunity to hold very frequent town hall meetings. I do that monthly in the Minneapolis airport among employees in Minneapolis. I also attend town hall meetings up on the Iron Range Center at the Chisholm Reservation Center. And I spend a fair amount of my time every week, and I schedule this time every week, to walk around the operation, work side by side with employees. Last week I was out on the ramp moving some bags, moving bags, loading airplanes, unloading airplanes with fellow employees, and through all of those interactions I've had the opportunity to hear from a large number of employees who desire to maintain this flexibility.
Representative Mansells.
Are these captive invitation-only meetings, these town meetings? And secondly, what would you say, 10%, 20%, 30%, 99% of the workforce wants this provision and this exemption from the Fair Labor Standards Act?
Mr. Lynch.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, these are not captive meetings. These are ad hoc random meetings which are voluntarily attended by employees. They are made available to all employees. And I would say that not all employees desire this flexibility, need this flexibility, but if you were to ask me to estimate, I would say 10 to 20% of employees take advantage of that flexibility.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lilly.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ansel, we have some folks that have come down to, and I think it would actually be helpful. Some are from around the state, and I think if you were to hear these stories, I think it is really something that the employees want, including myself. It's
Rangers? Did you bring some Rangers?
I believe, you know, I'm real sensitive about what you define as a Ranger, so I got yelled at by...
Representative Lilly, do we have any Rangers?
Yes, sir, I hope.
If you have any Rangers, would you bring one down?
We have one coming.
Well, we can. Thank you.
It was allowed in their union.
While we're waiting for the next person to come on, Representative Nelson, did you have a question on this point, or do you want us to wait for a minute?
We can wait.
Okay.
I'll let
this part, I think, Mr. Chair and members, okay. I think will be helpful. And
sir, if you could identify yourself for the record, and please proceed, and brevity is always appreciated here.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Glenn Hammond from Hibbing, Minnesota. I work in the Iron Range Center.
Mr. Hammond, could you verify for us that Hibbing is, in fact, on the range? Thank you.
It is the center of the range.
Here we go. Okay, Mr. Hammond, please proceed.
Thank you so much for hearing from us. As a regular employee of Delta Airlines now for some 5 years, I have made use of the trading that we're able to do on a voluntary basis for the last 5 years. It has helped immensely myself. I'm also a small business owner, and it gives me the flexibility to work just two or three days a week and use the rest of the time that I have in my other business. And it also helps employees that that travel for large distances. On the Iron Range, there aren't a lot of great jobs. Delta offers some wonderful jobs for us. And we have people coming from Hill City, from Big Fork, from Duluth area, up to the Iron Range Center to work. And with this voluntary trade, it benefits the employee, not the company. When operational conditions arise in the industry, they offer overtime, which they're very happy to pay us to work. So we're not dismissing overtime by any means, but we're asking for the exemption so that we can conduct our lives in a more...
We're with you.
Okay.
Thank you, sir. Representative Van Zels.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sir, are you a Ranger by birth?
Born and raised in Hibbing.
Went to school there, too.
Representative Nelson.
Birth certificate. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I guess I won't get into the whole Iron Range thing, but normally I guess I would have concerns about a bill of this nature. From the industry I come from, we're always getting pressure to work, go around overtime rules. From looking at this and talking to it, and I guess from what Representative Lilly Hill said, and I'd like to have verification of that, before when you had a union contract, this was in your union contract? It was allowed by through bargaining within the union contract?
Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, that is correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The other question I guess I had originally was, there is no intention, I guess, of this creeping into other industries, because I would have concerns there, because there could be ways of manipulating where it wouldn't be voluntary. And I guess that, to me, that's the parts of this bill, that it's voluntary and that they've had this before, that would allow me to vote for this in the past. I mean, normally I would be opposed to voting for something like this, and I think right now with the way it is and what testimony I've heard, that I would be in favor of this bill.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. I think only if we get flying carpenters will there be an issue, but as far as I know, we're good.
Mr. Chair, it's very much, and Representative Nelson and others, it's very much considered a perk. I mean, it's a, you know, it's an actually a job enhancement of why you might choose that as a career, because you can do some of this. But I have a couple other people, and just
okay. If you could
hear from
go ahead and identify yourself for the record and testify, and again, brevity is always appreciated.
My name is Brenda Deutsch, and I've worked with Delta for 17 years. And without the trade policies that we've had in the past intact, it would really desperately and very tragically affect thousands of families throughout our workforce. My particular situation is that my husband has suffered 3 strokes since September of last year. He is not able to work, so I am the sole breadwinner. And I need the flexibility within my schedule as the sole breadwinner and the caretaker of my husband to have the flexibility to be able to be there during the week so that I work doubles on the weekend so that I free up days during the week that he goes to his various therapies and doctor's appointments. I can assure you my brevity in this will not dictate how strongly I feel that there are thousands of families. I have a coworker that has to travel twice a month down to Florida for a mother that lives by herself, and she handles all her doctor's appointments. The summers, I am a 17-year employee. I do not hold a summer vacation. We bid according to our seniority. Had it not been for the trade policies, I never in the last 17 years would have been able to take a summer vacation with my family. It's wonderful to be able to pick up shifts and money and hours and that type of thing, but mine goes so much deeper. It allows me to care for my family in the manner with which I have to and which I need to. So I strongly recommend that you consider, and I'm only one of 30 in the area that I work in, but I can guarantee you every single one of those people that I work with came up to me and said, this can't happen.
Thank you very much, Ms. Doyce. Very nice, and our condolences about your husband. I hope things are getting better. Representative Lilly, anybody else? Or do
Mr. Chair, we have two other folks, but I think in the...
After that testimony, I think maybe vote now.
I think you kind of get the...
Anybody else in the audience that wants to testify for or against the bill? Members, any questions for the author or any testifiers? Seeing none, Representative Lilly, if you'd like to renew your motion...
I renew my motion that the House File 571 is moved to the General Register.
Representative Lilly renews his motion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Motion prevails. Congratulations.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay. Thank you, Representative Lilly. Mm-hmm. I'm going to pass the gal. Are you going to come and sit here? No, go ahead.
That was good.
And I will slide over and...
That's my job.
Excellent. Don't even worry about it. No, it's good.
You got my 10 amendments too?
Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, I would like to move House File 657, and this was on the bill, and we were going to vote on this today. We are just going to hear testimony on this bill, and we're going to vote on it next Wednesday in committee. So I will be very brief, and I will let other testifiers come down and start talking about it, and I will try to encourage everybody, whether or not they are an Iron Ranger, I will try to encourage everybody to be brief. Brian McNamara, if you want to come down and start.
Representative Hoppe, you want to move the A6 and get it in the shape that you'd like?
Yeah, while Mr. McNamara is coming down, I will move the A6 amendment. And what the A6 amendment does is it's leaving Sections 1 and Sections 3 of the bill, and that would get the bill. That's the bill that we will have before us, and that's the bill we would look at next week. And Representative Sanders, Mr. Chair, while we're at it, somebody forgot to move the minutes earlier. We didn't have a quorum when we started. If you want to move the minutes from the last meeting or have someone do that.
Representative Crawford, have you looked at the minutes? You so moved. Excellent. All in favor of the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are approved. Representative Hoppe to the A6.
Go ahead, Brian.
Has the amendment been moved?
Yep.
It has been
moved.
It is
before.
Mr. McDaniel?
Sorry. Oh, okay. So you? Well, first and foremost, Brian McDaniel, thank you very much for the allowing us to testify today. This is actually my first time being on this side of a Commerce Committee, so it's an interesting perspective. I would like to first introduce Dusty Brighton, who is from eBay, which is also part of StubHub, and he will be happy to walk us through the amendment. Do we have it in front of us?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Could you please state your name for the record and then proceed?
My name is Dustin Brighton.
I am the Senior Manager of Government Relations with eBay. The amendment here, sir, on page 1, line 14, after persons, insert including but not limited to those venues for which public funding has been provided for the construction, maintenance, or operation of the venue or any infrastructure related to it, which is located on property owned by a municipality or other government entity. And then on page 2, line 4, after the second comma, insert for initial sale. Page 2, line 7, after the period, insert a ticket issuer does not include a person involved in or facilitating ticket resale. And on page 2, delete section 2. Page 3, line 19, after resold, insert or transferred.
No.
Page 4, just delete section 4. Page 5, delete sections 5 and 6. Page 5, line 18, delete January 1st, 2012, and insert August 1st, 2011. And then obviously, renumber the sections in sequence to correct the internal references and amend the title accordingly.
Thank you, Mr. Brighton. Members, do you have any questions to the A6 amendment? If not, we'll move to a vote on the A6 to get it in the shape the author would like. All those in favor of the A6 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Amendment prevails. Representative Hoppe, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the A6, or the bill as amended, I think we'll go ahead and start with testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, my name is Dustin Brighton, Senior Manager of Government Relations for eBay, Inc., and I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. In the spirit of brevity, I will focus on sections 1 and 3 in my testimony here today. eBay is the world's largest marketplace with over 89 million active users worldwide who buy and sell almost everything from automobiles to video games and everything in between, including live event tickets. Adding to its legacy of improving inefficient markets, eBay acquired StubHub 3 years ago and has grown the company into the largest online marketplace for tickets, offering best-in-class consumer protections, including a fan protect guarantee that ensures fans will get into an event or receive 100% of their money back. At eBay and StubHub, we fundamentally believe that open, transparent markets free of artificial restraints are the best way to deliver low prices and value to customers. However, there's one absolutely critical component. For efficient markets to remain efficient and benefit consumers, and that component is open transferability. This bill, HF 657, ensures that open transferability. In the past year or so, primary ticketing companies have been rolling out services that would either outright prohibit the free transferability of tickets, or even more insidious, force consumers to only resell through authorized or approved exchanges by the primary ticketing company from which they initially purchased the ticket. The underlying technology that primary ticketing companies are using to block open transferability is called restricted paperless ticketing. While eBay and StubHub continuously create and embrace new technologies, we do not support technologies when they are used to block consumers from using competing marketplaces and artificially raise prices to consumers. Technology should be used to empower consumers as opposed to restricting them. So how does a restricted paperless ticket exchange work? Suppose you purchase a restricted paperless ticket to a concert and cannot use the ticket. According to Ticketmaster's website, you must use Ticketmaster's paperless ticket exchange to resell the ticket, and more important, you cannot sell the ticket below face value. So if you live in a market where the artist isn't very popular, and you can no longer use that ticket, you might be happy to get $20 for that ticket you paid $50 for. However, because of the ticket exchange rules, you're out of luck. Ticketmaster's paperless ticket exchange not only won't let you sell your ticket at market price, but it also prevents you from giving that ticket away or selling it to a colleague on eBay because restricted paperless tickets are otherwise non-transferable. The state of Minnesota in 2007 passed legislation to allow consumers to enjoy an open and efficient secondary tickets market. So I would encourage the committee to please vote for HF 657 to protect that market from being undermined. On behalf of the over 220,000 StubHub users located in Minnesota, I appreciate the opportunity to address the committee today. Thank you.
Are there any questions for the testifier? Seeing none, is there anyone else who would like to testify for or against the bill in the audience? Hi, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
For the record, my name is Daniel Pulliam, and I'm the Director of Government Relations for Ticket Network, and I'm responsible for the Better Ticketing Association and the member businesses who participate in the free market for ticketing throughout the country and in Minnesota. Mr. Chairman, members of the Commerce and Regulatory Reform Committee, good afternoon, and thank you for the opportunity to testify. We support the concepts raised as amended in House File 657 because the bill will ensure that consumers have the necessary information to purchase and transfer tickets to live entertainment events as they see fit. It is our belief that when a consumer buys a product in the market, including live entertainment tickets, that the consumer owns that product. The protections proposed in HF 657 create an important step forward for consumers. By affording these rights to consumers, you will put the power of ticketing squarely in the hands of the people who should have the most control, the consumers. The requirement in the bill to allow consumers to choose the type of ticket that best suits their lifestyle will provide consumers with the options that they deserve. In today's ticketing world, consumers are often forced to choose which events they will attend months ahead of time. In doing so, consumers take the risk that an unexpected situation, family event, or illness may prevent them from attending the show. When this happens, consumers need to have the most flexibility possible to ensure that they are protected from anti-consumer practices that prevent them from giving away, transferring, or reselling their tickets as they see fit. In certain restrictive paperless ticketing schemes, we have found that tickets are not only restricted from free transfer, but that consumers may actually lose money because artificial price floors set by the primary ticketing company prevent the original purchaser of a ticket from recouping the full cost of what they paid to acquire those tickets. This attempt to control the ticket market and pricing further harms consumers because when an event is not sold out or not as popular, below face value options that exist in the market right now will no longer be available. For example, tickets to tonight's Timberwolves game against the Los Angeles Lakers are currently selling for as low as $7 per ticket. You should also be aware that even though these tickets are selling below face value on the open market, the teams and venues received 100% of their asking price for these tickets. If a restrictive paperless ticketing system established price floors, none of these below face value options would be available. Any attempt to take this important right of ownership away from consumers and to allow someone else to insert their own judgment and decision making for that of the consumers is simply wrong. The use of paperless ticketing as a method of controlling consumers is not a great step forward for consumer rights and is a premise that we would urge this committee to reject. Thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today in support of consumer rights that are found in House File 657, and I look forward to working with the committee leadership and the members of the committee on this important initiative. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and proceed with brevity, if you will, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Potter. I'm president of the Fan Freedom Project, a consumer membership organization that was launched 1 week ago to promote the rights and interests of live event fans nationwide. Our board includes senior executives of the National Consumers League, the nation's oldest consumer advocacy organization, and the executive director of NetChoice, an association of online companies that supports open competitive markets. America is the land of individual rights and property rights with free markets and fair consumer protections. We have vibrant consumer-driven resale markets that work well for millions of people every day. We buy and sell cars, televisions, even Beanie Babies, on used car lots, yard sales, and over the internet. But imagine if the products we purchased came with resale prohibitions. or a requirement that resale go exclusively through the original retailer at a price that retailer sets. That's what is happening in the event ticketing market, and that is why the Fan Freedom Project's first initiative is the Ticket Choice Campaign, promoting fans' rights to buy, sell, or share their tickets that they purchased when they want, on whatever market they want, and at the price they choose. Minnesota currently enjoys an open, convenient market for event tickets, driven by supply and demand. When the Twins opened Target Field, ticket demand skyrocketed, yet consumers could still buy tickets on the resale market, usually above face value, but sometimes below. Likewise, many thousands of Vikings, Wild, and Gopher fans regularly buy and sell tickets on the resale market. So long as the resale markets are transparent, competitive, and consumer-protected, buyers and sellers are happy, regardless of whether the ticket is sold above the original face value or below. And team owners, theater owners, concert venues, event producers have no legitimate basis to complain. They set the retail price for every single ticket that is sold, and they receive full, fair price. But consumers' rights to buy and sell tickets are being undermined, as Ticketmaster, event producers, and sports teams are beginning to use the internet and technology against consumers through restrictive paperless ticketing. Restrictive paperless tickets are presented as innovative, convenient, environmentally friendly, but make no mistake, they are aimed squarely at reducing your rights and mine to resell or share our tickets that we purchase. Consider the Cleveland Cavaliers, which issued thousands of so-called convenient paperless tickets, and then LeBron James left town, and thousands of people are trying to sell those tickets. And you know what? They can't sell those tickets unless the Cleveland Cavaliers give them permission, and unless the Cleveland Cavaliers tell them what price they can sell it for. Left unchecked, this type of ticketing practice will make its way to Minnesota, so consumers are already opposing it. In only 1 week, more than 7,000 consumers have joined the Fan Freedom Project, and nearly 400 of them are your constituents here in Minnesota. HF 657 will protect Minnesota's highly successful, popular, competitive, and consumer-protected markets for ticket exchange. In doing so, it will protect Minnesotans from anti-consumer ticketing practices that are increasingly appearing in markets across the country. On behalf of fans everywhere, but especially here in Minnesota, I urge you to support passage of this legislation, and I thank you for allowing me to appear today.
Thank you, Mr. Potter. Next person up to testify on the bill, please. And I'll just remind everyone to please be brief and speak to the bill as amended. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is David Balser. I'm the director of ticketing at Target Center Arena in Minneapolis. Target Center, which is a city-owned building, is home of the Minnesota Timberwolves, Minnesota Lynx, and numerous concerts, family events. Target Center provides over 600 jobs in Minnesota to both full-time and part-time employees. In the past 5 years alone, we have sold over 2.8 million tickets while hosting approximately 200 events a year. Since Target Center opened its doors in 1991, we've contributed over $120 million in state taxes. At Target Center, our primary goal is to sell as many tickets as we can while providing a fair and efficient process to ensure that Minnesotans have an equal chance to purchase good tickets at fair prices to our events. The majority of the events that take place in Minnesota do not sell out. Unfortunately, the stakeholders of live events, promoters, venues, can lose hundreds of thousands of dollars on a single event alone. Scalpers have little stake in the game and reap huge rewards by charging excessive amounts for money for tickets that consumers, in many cases, can simply purchase at face value in the primary market. On October 21st, 2007, we hosted Hannah Montana, which I believe kind of started this whole loop. This was easily the most sought-after ticket in my 10 years of experience in major arenas. The event sold out in minutes, and countless Minnesota fans were unable to purchase tickets at face value. Scalpers were listing tickets online at well over 100 times face value. Our Minnesota customers were outraged. We later learned that bot software was used by scalpers to circumvent lines in the online ordering process. This software has since been deemed illegal in Minnesota. Unfortunately, a practice still takes place today. Then came October 29, 2009, the return of Miley Cyrus. This was the first ever arena level tour to exclusively sell paperless ticketing. This is the only time that Target Center has ever used this technology. I'm here to say today that it was a huge success for our arena. At no point in the purchasing process on our system did tickets ever sell out. Minnesota consumers were always able to purchase tickets at face value from Target Center. At the end of the day, we only sold 35 fewer tickets than in 2007. We sent a post-event survey to everyone that purchased tickets for this event, and the amount of praise that we got was enormous. of the 16,000 people that attended, we received only 10 complaints from our post-event feedback. As I'm sure you know, in the court of public opinion, customers will certainly let you know if they're upset about an issue, especially if given the opportunity. Our paperless approval rating was well over 99%. I will read just a few comments that we received from the feedback. I thought the paperless process was handled very well, and we hope that this will be used for future concerts because we could actually get tickets for the event. I absolutely love the paperless ticket option. This seems to largely reduce the number of scalpers and makes the show accessible to more people. I would love it if all shows of this magnitude would choose this paperless option. The point now I'd want to touch on is the secondary market and some techniques and methods that they use against Minnesota consumers. One method is by creating deception in the marketplace by posting speculative tickets. We are lucky enough to bring a Keith Urban concert to the consumers of Minnesota on October 15th later this year at Target Center. This event was announced to the public months ago, but tickets do not go on sale until this April. To make it clear, I'm the person in charge of building the events on the system, and as of yet, I haven't even started working on this event. If you visit TicketNetwork.com's website, you'll find 338 speculative tickets offered with a top price of $717. Not a fair value. On Minneapolis-Theater.com, Minnesota consumers will find 516 tickets available with a top price of $776. Between these two sites alone, that is 854 tickets for an event that I haven't even manifested one ticket for. Speculative postings backfired for StubHub earlier this year as they were forced to take down all BCS championship tickets off their website because one of their larger scalpers oversold his inventory. So how do scalpers go about securing these speculative or other prime tickets for events? I've investigated this online and found some answers on one scalper's blog, which I will quote now. The vast majority of my inventory is from pulling tickets from the primary sale. I have a huge edge when Lady Gaga at Madison Square Garden goes on sale because I can navigate Ticketmaster.com faster than just about anyone. For big on sales, I have an email list of a bunch of college friends who will try to pull tickets for me for a $10 or so commission per ticket. There are also various software programs of questionable legality that I've used in the past. A lot of times, ticks are released back into the system. Brokers like me use various scripts and programs that will pull for ticks all the time and alert me when they become available. I'd say about 30% of my inventory comes from releases and another 30% from on sales. So now I'll do my best to explain the script that this particular scalper is explaining. I'm certainly not an expert in the technology, but I can definitely tell you how it shows up on my side of the system.
Mr. Balser, I'm going to ask you to wrap things up here fairly quickly and stick to the bill as amended.
When consumers purchase tickets at our events, I can see how many tickets are queued on our system at one time. Basically, I can see as people are looking at tickets. At any given moment for events that are on sale, we have 0 to 15 people or tickets in queued at one time. Yesterday, I released 40 good tickets for our Usher concert, both floor and side seats. And in minutes, the queued level went up to 450 seats. 5 minutes later, the queued level was at 4,000 seats. We don't get that many requests for our on-sales alone. We probably get like 3,000 to 4,000 for our on-sales. So this was a release that was done at a random moment. It wasn't publicized to anybody. Within 5 minutes of 4,000 were in queue status. 30 minutes after this took place, the number of seats in queue status was back down to 15. The ultimate result, scalpers in New York secured 14 tickets, California 10 tickets, Rhode Island 6 tickets, Oklahoma 2 tickets, and Texas 2 tickets. Out of the 40 tickets that I've opened, Minnesotans were able to buy 6. So how do scalpers in these states outside of Minnesota secure tickets instantaneously after they release for sale? Unfortunately, I don't know the answer to that question. In conclusion, paperless is a legitimate delivery option which should be used at the sole discretion of the stakeholders involved, promoters, artists, managers, and venues. The fact that StubHub and other ticket scalpers are the only ones lobbying for this bill to pass should be an immediate red flag to this committee. It's not about consumer freedom to them, it's simply about their bottom line. It's artists, promoters, and venues. If artists, promoters, and venues don't like paperless or hear from their fans that they don't like paperless, we will simply stop using it. Legislation will unnecessarily hinder this process. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ball. So I want to take a quick opportunity. Is there anyone that wants to testify that's traveling from out of town?
Like the range?
Like the range? Okay, then we'll move on to the next testifier. And again, please keep your comments brief. And the bill was amended, so please keep your comments to the bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Bill Huepenbecker. I work for the Minnesota Wild. In addition, we also operate the XL Energy Center. If you could have someone pass these out, I don't know if we're going to have a chance to get to everybody that is in opposition to this bill today, but I just want to briefly read the people that are in opposition to it, opponents to the bill as amended. Minnesota State High School League, Minnesota Orchestra, Minnesota State Fair, Minnesota Timberwolves, Minnesota Twins, Minnesota Vikings, Minnesota Wild, AEG Live, Feld Entertainment, Jam Productions, Live Nation Entertainment, Northrop Auditorium, University of Minnesota, Orpheum Theater, Pantages Theater, Rose Presents, St. Paul Saints, State Theater, Target Center, and XL Energy Center. So those are the people that oppose the bill. Most of them Minnesota-based companies or venues that are in the state doing business. And to talk more about the XL Energy Center and Minnesota Wild, Jack Larson from the team to address the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Jack Larson, the Vice President and General Manager of the XL Energy Center. Bill and I are representing the Minnesota Wild and the XL Energy Center. I'd like to say that we are the ones that are invested in this community. We employ 250 full-time employees and over 1,200 part-time employees. Last year alone, we paid over $10 million in sales and income tax to the state of Minnesota. We draw more than 1.7 million fans to XL Energy Center each year, which generates more than $100 million in economic impact on the community annually. We are the ones assuming the risk, along with the promoters. We've made the investment in advertising and marketing these events, and in some cases, or most cases, guaranteeing a profit to an event. We are the ones invested in bringing the best live entertainment to St. Paul and keeping our venues in pristine condition. We are the ones who deliver the customer service experience, from the box office to security to first aid. We feel we must have the ability to decide how to sell our own product. Most events do not sell out. They have to be creatively marketed, and expenses have to be tightly controlled in order to produce a profit, just like any business. We must have flexibility in how our product is offered and sold. This legislation is not about creating flexibility for the customer. Those options are readily available. This is about making it easier for scalpers to be the middleman, to drive up prices and make a profit on an event for which they have made zero investment. What's worse is that oftentimes this ends up being most frustrating for the fan because their practices are not transparent, they sell tickets in non-existing locations, and often before they're even publicly for sale. As the Minnesota Wild, we want to control the product. If we invest in an event, we have to be able to control how we manage our financial risk. Artists need to control how they offer their tickets. People already have a variety of options for ticket delivery. Paperless is just one of many. We understand scalpers are part of this business, but because of our investment and financial risk in this event, we cannot have scalpers dictating how we run our business. Thank you for the opportunity to address the committee.
And Mr. Chairman, members, I just want to add a couple of things to follow up on some of the testimony earlier. Right now, the Minnesota Wild has a few paperless tickets. 110 of our fans selected that option this year. I know we heard a lot of talk about Cleveland and what's going on in that market. In our market, there is transferability among that the people can transfer their tickets. They can print them out at home. They can give to other people. There's an opportunity for them to resell their tickets. So, from how we're operating right now, we're using paperless tickets, but not to the effects that you've heard earlier today. And we can also repeat the stories that David Balser of Target Center mentioned about concert tickets showing up on secondary sites before the tickets are made available. Examples of Taylor Swift concert, we did a screenshot and we give copies to the committee of all the different various secondary ticket brokers that listed the tickets on the internet. And 2 hours before any tickets were available for sale, they were available for 2, 3, 4 times the price. These were not fans that were buying the tickets. They were people that were buying the tickets not to go to the show, but to resell them. So it's not all about the detriment of the fans as you know it's been portrayed here. So that concludes our testimony, and we have more folks to come up.
Thank you much for your testimony. And the next folks, come on up to the table. Again, please introduce yourself for the records. Please be brief in stating new information for the committee, and proceed.
Mr. Chair, I'm Dave St. Peter, the president of the Minnesota Twins Baseball Club. We appreciate the opportunity to be here today. from the Twins' perspective, we are not a Ticketmaster team. We ticket in conjunction with Tickets.com, which is part of Major League Baseball Advanced Media. We drew more than 3.2 million fans to Target Field in our inaugural season in 2010, and I'm happy to report we're on track to do that again in 2011. In 2010 alone, the Minnesota Twins organization generated over $25 million in state in income tax in the state of Minnesota. And why, you know, I find it interesting that we're here today listening to secondary market companies, specifically StubHub, eBay, based out of state, trying to tell us how frankly us, the Minnesota companies here, our sports franchises and our other venues, should operate our business. To the specifics of the proposed legislation, the Twins need to sell 3 to 3.3 million tickets on an annual basis. Needless to say, we are incented to make our tickets available to the consumers the way they want them, in the most convenient way, in the most efficient way, in the most secure way. Frankly, with hopes that as many Minnesotans, and I underscore the word Minnesotans, can buy those tickets at face value, especially the average fans. And clearly, we believe that the convenience of giving the fan the opportunity to have paperless tickets is in the interest of fans and, frankly, what many of our fans want. And particularly in a day and age when technology continues to evolve, I'm not sure why we would eliminate that option from the consumer. Beyond that, I can tell you there are growing concerns with fraud surrounding tickets, and certainly tickets sold in the secondary market. It was a huge issue for us at Target Field. And clearly, tickets that are sold in an electronic manner help mitigate that fraud. With that, I'll turn it over to the next.
Thank you. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
My name is John Nuppel. I'm the ticket sales manager for the Minnesota Vikings. And I have been in Minnesota ticketing business for almost 20 years. We joined the other teams and venues across Minnesota in opposition to this bill. Briefly, Viking ticket policies are built upon the best way to serve our customers. This includes having convenient and fair ticketing procedures. We feel denying Minnesota Vikings fans the use of paperless tickets goes against the technological advances of our industry as we try to best service our customers. The ease and convenience of paperless tickets, much like in the airline industry, are the way ticket owners will gain access to their seats each Sunday in the future if they desire. Paperless ticketing has a number of benefits. It is a convenient way for fans to store all their ticket information in one place. We have many fans who attend all of our games, and by not having to keep track of physical, hard copy tickets, they won't have to be concerned with lost, stolen, or misplaced tickets. We may be able to reduce the level of potential fraud, reduce the likelihood of counterfeit tickets, and provide an overall increased level of ticketing security. Most of all, we want to provide them with options that will be convenient and secure. We ask that you let us continue to provide our fans ticket options that may work best for them. Please oppose this legislation. Thank you.
Mr. Nuppel, Representative Atkins has a question for you.
There's a question that I think is the, when it comes to paperless tickets, that's sort of the burning issue, and that is, if it's 4:30, if the game starts at 5:30, Gophers game, something like that, I got a couple of tickets or I've got the right to go, and I want to give them to my friend, Representative Anseltz. How do I do that in the world of paperless?
We'll work that out.
Is there, seriously, though?
We don't have it now. This is an afternoon.
Mr. Nuppel.
You're not being funny, are you? But it's, I get some tickets that way. I give away tickets that way. That, to me, is as just a sports fan. If I want to, go to a Twins game.
Mr. Chair, my name is Jim Sheely, and I represent the Historic Theater Group managing the Orpheum State and Pantages Theaters for Canopy Theater Trust. I could answer that question, Representative. We have one experience with Trans-Siberian Orchestra. Now, we only put 25% of the tickets on paperless ticketing, and the rest of them were ticketed through normal channels. So consumers had a lot of opportunities. As far as transference, we had great experience with that. No one was denied entry. If the tickets were purchased as a gift or ended up as a giveaway, there were letters of authorization created that could go along with paperless ticket that would allow the purchaser to gift the ticket to another individual. We verified that along with ID from the original purchaser, a copy of the ID, and the patron was admitted. So that worked very well for us in that case.
And I appreciate that. It may have worked very well for you, but it sounds like it'd be a real pain in my butt to try to do.
No,
I mean, just as a typical fan, I'm just trying to take care of Representative Anseltz here.
You could just print a ticket.
That's correct. You could print a ticket. You could contact the ticket office, and we could print a ticket and have it waiting.
And
turn it over with normal ID.
Representative Atkins.
So I've got paperless tickets currently at 4:30. I want represented. I can't go because this hearing's going to go for a while longer. Twins game's going to start in an hour. I want to give it to Representative Anseltz. And he's coming from the range, he says. But so he shows up at Target Field or at the Viking Stadium or wherever the event is. What is it? He goes to a ticket booth and says, I'm here for Representative Atkins. He had tickets that he bought. He can't use them. He wants me to go. What would we do?
I Mr. think the Neppel important thing to remember Mr. is Schilling? That we're in the service business, and customer service is our number one priority. We have to do it all the time, or people just don't come back. You know, it's part of it's about the act, part of it's about what we do for people. We're going to figure this out to make it work, because it's in our best interest to make it work. There's just no question about it.
I agree.
Just as an example, I want to give you just a reading, a short letter from the Attorney General that demonstrates what happens when we can't service a customer. This was to my colleague.
A letter from the Attorney General.
The Deputy Attorney General. This is a letter to my colleague Tom Hoke at Hennepin Theater Trust. Dear Mr. Hoke, this office was contacted by Ms. Elizabeth Sawyer, whose address is 4319 Shawan Avenue South, Minneapolis. Ms. Sawyer states that she visited www.orpheum-theater-minneapolis.com to buy tickets to Billy Elliot, the Orpheum Theater, Minneapolis. She chose tickets for herself and her goddaughter directly in front of the orchestra pit for $91 each. So that would be the front row. She was later informed that there was a $15 mailing fee as well as a $16.84 service fee. She purchased the tickets for the performance on January 2, 2011. When she received the tickets, they appeared to come from Ticketmaster. When they arrived at the theater, they learned their seats were not directly in front of the orchestra pit, but in the very last row. After speaking with other attendees, she learned that everyone in the last row thought they were to be seated directly in front of the orchestra pit, and that all of their tickets had been purchased from the same website. She also noticed that the tickets were printed as being purchased by James Rodriguez and that the Orpheum staff told them he is a scalper. She states she paid $230 for $96 worth of tickets. On January 3, 2011, she clicked on the confirmation email she received and contacted OnlineTicketOrders.com. She was told she needed to contact the ticket seller, who was Ticket Network Direct. She has been unable to receive a refund for the difference between the amount she paid for the tickets and the amount the seat should have cost. She wants Hennepin Theater Trust to ensure that she receives a refund of $134.68 signed by Jesse Tuttle, Office of the Minnesota Attorney General. So the Attorney General wants us to cover a refund for what a scalper, Theater Direct, who spoke here, sold to misleadingly for a front row seat that placed them in the back of the auditorium.
Representative Mullery.
For you all.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Nobody's answered the question that Atkins asked, Representative Atkins. I've had basketball tickets for the U, and chairs sometimes run over, and they tell us we're running over a long time. I may give it to somebody here. Other times I've left it with a neighbor because I wasn't sure if we were going to get out, and nothing that you've come up has answered how we can do that on a short-term basis. And so I think I happen to be one who voted against the allowing scalping, so I'm not on that side, but until you come up with a really solid answer to Representative Atkins' issue and my issue, I don't see how we support your side on this.
Mr. Huebenbecker.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mullery, Representative Atkins.
Oh.
What we do at the Minnesota Wild is we have the e-tickets, people that have them. You can go on our website. You have your own account on the website. You can't make it to the game. Representative Atkins, you just go to the website, print the tickets from your printer, give them to Representative Manziel, goes to the game. Now, maybe some of the people here don't have it figured out because they haven't used the tickets, but I'll tell you what, it's in our best interest for our customers and our season ticket holders. We want them to be able to use their tickets in the manner that they see fit. And so as the other organizations figure out how to use these, they're going to figure out those methods to accommodate those patrons. We've done that. So there are other options. We've successfully done that, and we have not got any complaints from our season ticket holders. So it's not as complicated as maybe some people made it sound, but it's just that easy. If you got a paperless ticket from the Minnesota Wild, go to your computer, go to the website, print it off, and give them to the next person that you want to go to the game.
Mr. Chairman, just not everybody carries a computer around with them. Okay. Your answer doesn't make it, so I hope you come up with a lot better before we vote on this.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if you were at work and you didn't have your tickets with you, and they're at home, it'd probably be easier to print them from your computer and give them to someone else to go to the event. So I think it might be actually a little more convenient.
Thank you for that answer. Representative Dietrich had a question.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So just to give me a better picture of what this e-ticket looks like, is it similar to the airlines now where you can go check in for your flight using your cell phone? Do any of you have that capability? Is that the type of e-ticket you're talking about, or is it strictly through your email only?
Mr. Chairman, there are several ways that you can do paperless ticketing. We were looking at doing a magstripe card that we couldn't get done in time for the season. So what our season ticket holders did is it's on their Visa card. So when they come to the game, they go up to the ticketing agent, they swipe their card, it prints out a receipt with their seat location in the row and their seat numbers and directs them to their seat. So that's how we've done it. Now, is the technology there where you could do it through your cell phone, or is that going to evolve and change? It is, but from our perspective and the way we do business, we're always going to have those options for our customers. When they're our season ticket holders, we want them to maintain them to be season ticket holders. We want them to have a good experience at the game and throughout the whole process. It's part of our brand, and we want them to feel good about the Minnesota Wild. So we're going to continue to accommodate their needs as this technology evolves.
Thank you for that. Are both of you gentlemen in town here, and are you available to come back a week from tomorrow, Wednesday?
I'm not. I'm actually from Chicago.
Okay. Well, we are approaching our deadline right now.
Okay.
Go ahead. Please introduce yourself, and please keep it as brief as possible.
My name is Andrew Kaplan from Jam Productions. We've been a promoter, a very active promoter in Minnesota and the Twin Cities since the 70s, started when I was 3 years old. We are we're a major producer of events here. I work as a talent buyer. My primary responsibility is to work directly with musicians and artists and their representatives to fulfill their artist vision, how they communicate with their fans. I'm responsible for making sure that the artist vision of how they want to have their fans experience their event is fulfilled. And it is an experience that goes well beyond the walls of a venue when the event actually takes place, but it extends into areas like how a fan gets their tickets, very important. Most of the artists we work with have a clear expectations on ticketing. They want as many fans to get tickets in their hands as possible and at face value, the price that they determine. They are the ones who pick the price. They have an expectation and a goal that their fans should have a fair shot at face value tickets. We agree it's an important part of building a band and building a brand, which is really what we're talking about. Fans are wary. And they're looking for people to look out for them during the purchase process. We really feel like that's what we've got to look out for here. Ticket scalpers, now charitably called the secondary market, are extensively using bot technology, which has been already mentioned, which can pretty much make the process an extremely unfair process for the average human being. I likened it to the recent Jeopardy situation, where you had a computer against these two human beings, and the computer seemingly always was able to press the button faster. That's what we have seen for years and decades. And there are finally tools at our disposal, some of which are low technology and some of which are new technology. And for years, we've had certain artists like Pearl Jam, like Prince in different situations, like Tom Waits, Bruce Springsteen, who have made very clear to us how they want to their fans to buy tickets. And in the past, it's been, thank you for being my fan. If you want to come to the show, you need to come to the box office, pick up your tickets, and go directly into the venue. Fans appreciate that. Very few feel inconvenienced by it. The new technology is paperless ticketing. What you've been hearing about in terms of the way sporting teams work with the technology is slightly different than the way that Randy and I, in our role as promoters, and ask the venues to work with the technology. Sometimes it's 25% of the capacity of the venue, the best seats in the house. We want to make sure that those are the ones that get in the fans. We want to make sure, and the bands make sure, that those are the tickets that get in the hands of fans, and that we want to know that those are the fans who actually show up the night of the show. There's been some discussion about issues related to transferability and whatnot, but I want to tell you that there's a sensitivity there, and I've talked to box office managers about that issue, but and they have found exceptions, but those complaints are minuscule in terms of the thousands of tickets that have been dealt with and have happily processed in that period of time. These are finally tools that are allowing us to come bring back the what the artist's vision is to the fans and not feel like they're being exploited. Because up to now, while it's been a nuclear arms race in terms of us trying to figure out how these companies, which have really out-engineered software and completely exploited us, we're finally at the point where we're turning a corner, and this is why you're receiving this kind of legislation and this kind of pushback in your legislatures. To my understanding, this is the kind of language that's being pushed throughout the country, and you'll expect to see that as you're tracking your counterparts in different places. I know you're short on time, so thanks for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Kaplan. Mr. Levi, is it okay if you come back on Wednesday and we'll put you at the top of the list?
Mr. Chair, I think I can keep it to 20 seconds or less.
Perfect. We'll cut you off at 30.
No problem.
All right.
The answer to your question is anybody that's a season ticket holder of any of these venues, you call the box office, they'll make an exchange for you. There's a process in the box office. They'll check your ticket. They'll check your credit card. You'll tell them who's coming. It's a telephone. If you can't print it out, if you can't find your computer, there's not one of us here who won't solve this. It's a new technology.
Yeah.
Yours and you can't talk. You cannot talk. I have 23 minutes. Our future's here. We're going to buy our groceries this way. Let's stay future think. We do not want the tail, the scalper, wagging our dog. We're taking the risk. That's where we're at. We're here telling you this is what we want to do business. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Levine. We'll still allow you to come back on Wednesday the 9th if you would like to. I'm going to let Mr. Brighton come back since he is coming, or he is from out of town. Got about 1 minute to wrap up your comments. We'd really appreciate that before we lay the bill over.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the additional time. Just a couple points of clarification. Number one, eBay and StubHub are electronic marketplaces. We do not purchase tickets and position inventory on the website itself. We connect the buyers and the sellers. And the next thing I'd like to say is, as far as technology, again, we promote technology. eBay and StubHub would not exist without it. What we worry about is restrictive paperless ticketing. Paperless ticketing sounds great. We're all about it. Would love to integrate with those that would be willing to do so. But it's restrictive paperless ticketing that's not good for consumers and is aimed squarely at the secondary market. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Brighton. Appreciate your testifying. Representative Hoppe, any final words before we lay the bill over?
Happy layover, Mr. Chair.
All right. Members, we will lay this bill over. Looks like we'll take it up Wednesday, March 9th.
We are adjourned.
We are adjourned.